You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Today, our luncheon guest is Berkman Fellow Jerome Ergu. He is part of the Cooperation Research Group here at the Berkman Center. He's also a PhD student at Sciences Po in economics, and he's here today to talk to us about the promises of web-based social experiments. So, thank you, Jerome.
So, thank you very much, Omar, for this very nice introduction. Thank you, everybody, for being here to listen about this presentation about the promises of web-based social experiments. So please feel free to interrupt me during the presentation if you have questions or comments. And let me directly jump in at the heart of the matter and trying to see what we're dealing with here, that is trying to measure social preferences and social norms online using experimental economics. So some very quick background. Experimental economics is a discipline that's grounded in game theory. Game theory is a mathematical language that describes strategic interactions between agents given a set of rules and generally assuming that those agents are perfectly rational and self-interested. So game theory is generally mainly interested in deriving the Nash equilibrium of a strategic interaction called a game, a Nash equilibrium being a strategy such as, no matter what the strategies of the other players around you in the game, you have no incentives to deviate from your own strategy. Your own strategy is your best response to the set of possible strategies of your opponents. And what experimental economics actually does is to take those theoretical scenarios and have actual subjects play them out in a university laboratory in order to see if they tend to deviate or not from the theoretical predictions that game theory is able to make. And as far as social games are concerned, we have observed that frequently subjects deviate from the game theoretic equilibrium of any game, and this has been very often interpreted as evidence of the presence of social preferences and social norms. So when we think about social preferences, we think about such things as altruism, norms of fairness, inequality aversion. Those kind of social preferences that are thought to be instrumental in sustaining and enforcing social norms at the community level. So in the most simple settings in experiments, subjects are generally anonymous. They play once for real money and without communicating. So this is not to say that economists purposefully model the situation as being representative of what happens in the real world. This is not the case. But those experiments can be used as a useful benchmark against which you can compare what is the effect of turning the soundtrack of life on. So what happens if suddenly you allow people to communicate to one another? How does that change the result of the strategic interaction you're studying? Same thing if you allow for repeated games and for learning in the games with the same people or with other people. How does that change the outcome of the strategic interactions? Those are the kind of things that you can address with experimental economics because experiments and games impose a clear structure on social concepts that are often vague or fuzzy, at least for economists to understand. Experiments are highly comparable across subject pools. They are also highly replicable, which, in my view, explains the fact that experimental economics is a useful frame for scientific discourse because you can replicate experiments, and by changing slight things in the design of the experiments, you can try and rule out the set of alternative hypotheses that you have for explaining the mechanism that drives the result of any particular interaction that you're studying and build by focusing on series of experiments, consensus within the scientific community about what factor actually drives the results that you're seeing in the interaction that you study. At least this is my hope. So why should we run social experiments online? Well, for the last two decades, the overwhelming majority of experiments that has been run by psychologists or economics or behavioral scientists have been run in such traditional university laboratories that you see in those pictures with undergraduate students, mostly American undergraduate students. Those that are labeled here, weird subject pools. So don't take me wrong. Weird here stands for Western educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. Nothing else. So the experiment that has been run during the last two decades with those kind of subjects have proven instrumental in showing the relevance and the presence of social preferences for determining a wide array of social and economic outcomes in strategic interactions. But we now need to move beyond the university laboratory approach. The discipline is at a turning point. Why is that? It's simply because we have increasing evidence that those weird subjects are not only a very thin slice of human mankind, but also frequent outliers along many dimensions we care about. So if we really want now to take advantage of the wide diversity that's available throughout the world in terms of social preferences and social norms, really try to explain how those social norms and preferences emerge at the community level and how they impact economic and social results at the community level, we now need to go beyond the university laboratory approach and try to reach more diverse subject pools. And to do that, the internet is one very efficient way, in my view, because it allows to reach an increasingly diverse and broad set of subjects at an affordable cost. And you could even think about running cross-cultural experiments online also at an affordable cost, which is, for the time being, very difficult to do. So this is one first reason why we should run experiments online. A second reason why we should run social experiments online is simply because the cyberspace is in itself a social place. So internet is in itself a field of experiments, of social experiments in its own right, and you may all have already seen this funny piece that illustrates this fact, and I guess I'm taking this one from Joey Ito, if it actually wants to work, not sure. Let's see.
Come on, we have to finish the quest in Stonehaven.
Stan?
Hang on, guys, my dad wants something.
Stan!
What?
You've been on your computer all weekend. Shouldn't you go out and socialize with your friends?
I am socializing, Artard. I'm logged on to an MMORPG with people from all over the world and getting XP with my party using TeamSpeak.
I'm not an Artard.
All right, sorry, guys.
Okay. So what this little funny piece illustrates is that the cyberspace is now part of the real social world, but with one slight difference. It has much more data. So whenever people interact, exchange, and communicate over the web, they virtually leave terabytes of data behind them that's readily available for social scientists to parse, to mine, and to analyze. And by bringing experimental tools onto the internet, we can actually couple two approaches, a fine-grained description, quantitative descriptions of what those people do in those online communities, and an elicitation of the social preferences and the social norms of those people in order to gain a higher power in our analysis of the dynamics of those online communities and also the foundations of individual behavior online. Another reason why we should run social experiments online that's very important is that we are currently seeing the increasing recognition of a new production model that leverages the affordances of the network to replace explicit monetary incentives with intrinsic work motivation, worker screening schemes by voluntary efforts and contributions, and top-down hierarchical institutions by massively distributed and hierarchical work coordinations. So you may have recognized what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about online commons-based peer productions as exemplified in the example of Wikipedia or open source software. And if you believe in what I have just been telling you, you will readily recognize that economists lack formal theories and models for explaining this new kind of social production. And we may need to look for a field of the social preferences economics of online commons-based peer production. And in order to understand how this new model of production works, putting experimental economics online and having those communities actually play out those theoretical scenarios could help us a lot. So after this quite long introduction, I would like to go about the motivations for this paper. This paper is mainly about methodology. Before trying to bring experimental economics tools online, what you would like to know is what happens when we have people play social games over the internet as compared to their behavior in the traditional laboratory setting. So the question that we ask is it possible by designing a proper online laboratory to get consistency of results online and in the lab? And it is still very surprising to me how limited is and scarce the literature on this subject. There has been very few studies that have been concerned in one way or another about comparing the results that you get from a lab experiment or a classroom experiment with the result that you get online. Some studies don't find an effect. Some studies do find an effect. What those studies have been finding is that online subjects seem to be less risk-averse than in the lab, and they tend to play significantly faster. However, in the current literature, there are three main drawbacks, in my opinion. First of all, the current literature does not perform any randomization of subjects between the online and the in-lab treatment, so that any difference in behavior, if you observe any, could simply arise from difference in the demographics of the two subject pools. A second point is that the literature does not control for response times. If you believe in the fact that subjects may play significantly faster online, then you may have a Kahneman and Tversky kind of story going on here, whereby people playing faster tend to rely on more emotional and instinctive reasoning processes as compared to people in the lab who take more the time of the reflection and are able to put in place cognitive and analytical rational processes. So this may be correlated with the fact of playing online and drive your underlying results. So you want to control for that. The third thing is that the current literature does not control for difference in beliefs between treatments. Do online subjects believe, as in-lab subjects, that they are paired with real human partners? Do they believe that you're going to calculate their final earnings as you describe and pay them at the end of the experiments? Those are things that you also want to control for, because this could drive your results. Yeah. In experimental economics. So those are the six papers I'm aware of that bear some kind of relevance on that issue. The last one of them is by a former Berkman fellow, Dave Rand. So the design of this experiment, as I said, we are asking the question, whether it's possible to achieve consistency of behavior in the lab and online by designing a proper online laboratory. To study this question, we use 5 standard decision problems. 4 of them are among the social games most studied in the current literature to think about social norms and social preferences. The last one is an individual task that measures risk aversion. I will explain them in more depth later. Each game is only played once, and at the end of the experiment, subjects are asked some standard socio-demographic and belief questions. So here is the first game that we had in the platform. It's the public good game. So I do not want to oversell this, but some scholars have described the setting of this game as describing the fundamental problem of social life. So this game basically relies on the fact that social norms that sustain human communities often demand that people give up private benefits to achieve a socially efficient goal. So if you think about waiting in the line to order your meal when you're really hungry, you are incurring a private cost to maintain a socially beneficial rule. This is the kind of situation I'm talking about here. Same thing holds about not going through a red light when you're late in a date. And if you want to think about more important examples, you can think about a bunch of countries individually deciding whether or not to enforce a regulation about forbidding to their national industries to rely on production techniques that are highly polluting, but also quite cheap, so that you could gain a comparative advantage over your competitors through this means. So in this very simple setting, subjects are grouped in teams of 4. Each subject has an endowment of $10, and each subject faces the same decision. You can either keep your endowment for yourself or decide to contribute whatever amount to a public good. For each dollar that you contribute to the public good, each dollar yields a return of $0.4 to each group member, including yourself. So the action of contributing is costly to you. You give $1, you get only 0.4 back. But if everybody does the same, the outcome is socially beneficial, because at the same time, you can benefit from the contribution of all the other people. The problem here being that no matter what the strategies of the other player, if you want to maximize your own earnings, you always have an incentive not to contribute anything to the common project and to see if you can free ride on the contribution of others to maximize your personal gains. So this is what basically the Nash equilibrium of the game tells you, that nobody should contribute in those kind of games. And in the lab, when people perform this game, those weird subjects I was talking about before, you actually see that people are generally willing to contribute roughly 50% of their endowment to the common project. The second game that we study is the dictator game. So the dictator game tries to capture a behavioral measure of some kind of altruism. Altruism being here an actor willing to take costly actions to increase the payoff of another actor, irrespective of that actor's previous actions. So it's all as if people were behaving as if they were taking pleasure in others' pleasure. So in this simple setting, people are grouped in pairs, one participant A, one participant B. Participant A has an endowment of $10. He has to decide whether to transfer anything to participant B, and this is the end of the interaction. The Nash equilibrium of these games basically tells you that participant A has no incentives to send anything to participant B. What you observe in the lab is that people are regularly willing to send about 20% of their endowment to participant B. The third situation we're studying is the ultimatum game. The ultimatum game tries to capture a behavioral measure of norms of fairness. Norm of fairness being defined here as people who think about unequal outcomes as being unfair would be willing to take costly actions in order to punish unfair behavior, although this comes at a cost to their own material payoff. So in this very simple strategic setting, people again are paired, one participant A, one participant B. Participant A has an endowment of $10. He has to decide whether or not to transfer anything to participant B. But this time, participant B gets a chance to state the minimum acceptable offer under which he will refuse the transfer of participant A. And if he does, both players earn nothing in that game. So this game, from participant B's side, is all about what participant B really consider as a fair share of participant A's endowment. And what is the expectation of participant A about what participant B consider as a fair offer? The basic Nash equilibrium of this game tells you that participant B should accept whatever positive amount participant A transfer because he's better off this way than with nothing. And anticipating this fact, participant A will transfer the minimum possible amount to participant B. What you actually observe in the lab is that weird subjects are generally willing to transfer between 30 to 50% of their endowment to participant B, and that participant B's very frequently reject offers that are equal or below to 20% of the endowment of participant A. The last social...
One thing you didn't say, yeah. What happens if it's rejected to participant A?
The participant earns nothing.
Okay. So participant A disappears if they don't.
Yeah. Okay. So there is no money in the game anymore. So you go home and participant B goes home with nothing. So the last social game that we study is the trust game. The trust game tries to capture a behavioral merger of trust, meaning that an actor is voluntarily placing resources at the disposal of another party without any legal commitment from this other party, but with an expectation that this party will be trustworthy and that the act will pay off in terms of the truster's goal. So this is all about the truster willing or not to make himself vulnerable to the decisions of participant B. Reciprocally, trustworthiness, defined behaviorally in this game, is about people willing to reward trust, that is, willing to behave reciprocally, although this causes a net reduction in their material payoff. So in this game, participants are again paired. Participant A has an endowment of $10. Participant B also has an endowment of $10. But participant A gets a chance to transfer whatever amount he likes taken from his endowment to participant B. Whatever amount he transfers is multiplied by 3 by the experimenter. And then participant B has a private decision to make how much to return to participant A. The Nash equilibrium of this game tells you that participant B, whatever amount he receives, will return nothing so as to maximize his own payoff. And anticipating this fact, participant A will not send anything to participant B in the first place. What we actually observe in the lab, as far as behavior is concerned among weird subjects, is that participant A's are willing to transfer roughly 50% of their endowment to participant B's, that participant B's exhibit positive reciprocity. The more you send, the more they return, but they generally tend to return slightly less than what you send. So that trust does not quite pay back, generally, in the lab. Finally, the last decision problem that we study is not a social game. Please.
Does B know what the original amount is?
Yeah. So the rules are common knowledge. Common knowledge...
They know that it's 3 times.
What they're receiving is 3 times.
Exactly. So common knowledge in all the games, meaning that I know that you know that I know that you know that I know infinitely this way.
And do the participants, these weird participants, have been checked for tendency towards gambling?
Yes. Well, maybe this will speak to your question, risk aversion. But what I would assume is that even if they have a tendency to gamble, there shouldn't be, according to the randomization procedure that we put in place, there shouldn't be any difference between both subject pool on that characteristic in the lab and online. So this is not a social game. This is a measure that we include, an individual task that we include, because the previous literature tended to suggest that online participants were less risk-averse than in-lab participants. And this table seems quite complicated at first sight, but actually it's quite simple. People have 10 decisions to make sequentially. And each decision, you have to decide between two gambles, gamble A and gamble B. In gamble A, you can always win either $20 or $16. In gamble B, you can always win either $38.50 or $1. The only thing that changes from one decision to another is that the probability that you get the higher amount in both gambles increases from 10% chance in decision 1 to 100% chance in decision 10. So that in decision 10, you're basically choosing between getting $20 with certainty with gamble A and $38.5 with certainty in gamble B. So that everybody should go for gamble B in that decision. So if you compute the expected value of each gamble for each decision, what you actually see is that a risk-neutral decision maker should go for option A up to decision 5 and then switch to option B. What people do in the lab is that they're willing to stick to option A much longer than that. That is, they exhibit risk aversion. And you can take the number of decision A's that they're willing to make as a measure of their risk aversion. The more they stick with this A gamble, the more they're risk averse.
Are they with these choices in that order?
Yeah.
So how do you distinguish between risk aversion and somebody's tendency to just stay out of course of habit with what they've already been doing? Those aren't quite the same thing.
You started from the bottom and went upward. You think they would stick with option B much longer?
Well, generally in experimental economics, whatever you change in the design, we change the decision. In my view, the important thing being that if you want to compare the results between two subject pools, you have to stick with the same experimental design. Then I'm not quite sure about your question about habits. Well, what you mean is that if you go for option A in the beginning, you may stick with that all the way through.
If I'm used to saying A 5 times, is it possible that the fact that I hit A the 6th time is less has to do with my not judging the risk aversion, the risk correctly, and more to do with course of habit as well? Where that is, suppose you randomly chose you.
I understand.
Instead of always being A and always being B, what if you randomly exchanged what A and B were so that that factor went away?
So I understand your point. I'm not quite sure that the strength of habit will show itself so forcefully in 10 decisions, but...
Can I make a comment, though? I mean, isn't the point of your study that this is a canonical economic game that's been played in labs for the last however many years, and you're really testing something very different, which is the variation between...
Online.
So,
right?
Yeah. That's definitely...
So in some ways, this is a study that is not about the design of this.
Almost replicating.
It's definitely not about the design of this particular experiment, which has been created in 2002 and repeated many times since then. But what you actually see is that most people do not do the kind of things that...
I just want to ask about the games. Were those games where people were face-to-face, or were they hidden from each other?
In online, you're basically playing alone at home, and in the lab, you're playing in the university laboratory, so you don't see the other players, but you know that you're playing the other players in the room.
Yeah, okay.
But this is an individual decision task,
I shall insist.
Yeah.
All those other games are played with real money.
Is
this also played with real money?
It's played with real money.
Okay.
Okay. So people's answers to this will determine how much money they get.
Exactly.
You can walk out of this one with a lot of money.
So in this game, we actually randomly pick one of the 10 decisions to pay subjects.
You don't get
paid on all the 10 decisions. We have people play those four social games and this decision task on a decision interface that we designed, and we designed an experimental platform that could be used as is, both online and in the lab, through an internet access. So, as I said, we need to control for the fact that subjects may play significantly faster online. So what we do is that we include a timer on each screen of the interface so that we can control for the overall time spent with the experiment, with the time spent with each game of the experiment, and even disaggregate at the screen level. A second thing is that we need to make sure that online participants can get quickly the basic gist of each game. And this was kind of a challenge because if you know how traditional experimental economics experiments are usually run in traditional university labs, you usually have to read through a rather abstract description of the rules of the game and then pass some kind of quiz to test whether you understood the basic social situation that's at hand. If you did not, you have to go to the instructions again, then pass the quiz again, and the experimenter will not let you perform the experiment unless he has some confidence that you broadly understand what's going on in the game. So obviously, this is something that's really difficult to implement online unless you're willing to accept a very high dropout rate out of your study. So what we're trying to do is to make this a little bit more fun and straightforward. So we include the flash animations that you saw previously along with the traditional experimental instructions on the description screens so that people can visually quickly get what's happening there, what is at stake. Yeah, it's the same decision interface, but you access the platform through an internet access on the lab. So it's basically the same thing. There is one slight difference. I will talk about it later. And we also replace the tedious comprehension questions by earnings calculators through which you can experiment with all the possibilities you're interested in before actually making your decision. So I can show you how that looks like. Well, let's go for the chess game, for instance. So here is how it looks. This is basically how one page of the experimental platform looks like, the earning calculators game for the chess game. So you have the basic setting. You can decide how much you want to send as participant A to participant B. You can transfer. You see that the amount is multiplied by 3. You get a bunch of bills. Now you're in the position of participant B, so that you understand both positions well. You decide of a return, and you get the numerical results of the example you decided to run. You can restart the animation and play with that as long as you want until you're happy with it, you feel like you understood what was happening, and you decide to make your decision. So we also need to control for differences in subjects' attention, experimental environments. We have an indicator of mouse inactivity so that if the mouse is inactive for more than 5 minutes, we know. We ask questions about whether people read how people read the descriptions associated with each of the games, whether they were in a calm environment when they answered the questions. We also need to control for differences in subjects' beliefs. So we ask them at the end of the experiments whether they actually believed that they were paired with human partners and whether they believed that we would calculate their earnings as we described and pay those earnings to them at the end of the experiment. So the experimental procedures. For this study, subjects were all recruited from an existing database of self-registered volunteers for participating in those kind of incentivized experiment at the University Paris-Sorbonne. So we open a bunch of sessions to perform this experiment. And after they register to participate for a given session, subjects are sent a confirmation email asking them either to come to the lab to perform the experiment, as is usually done, or to perform the experiments online by clicking on the study's URL. And the way we proceed with the randomization of subjects between treatments in order to minimize the differences in demographic characteristic between both subject pools is that we allocate people according to both treatments according to their registration order. For a given session, you're the first one to register, you go on the lab, you're the second one, you go online, and so on. So overall, we had 180 subjects who performed the experiments in the lab and 202 subjects who performed the experiments online. And one slight difference that has to be noticed is that we decided in the design of the experiment to stick with the traditional procedure of paying subjects in cash at the end of the experiment in the lab. But this was not possible for us to do online. So we decided to pay subjects for an automated PayPal transfers, and subjects were aware of that at the beginning of the study. But this is a difference in both treatment that we have to bear in mind and to which we shall, we may return.
You're saying it's a difference in treatment between the two subject pools that you used or versus other experiments in the past?
It's a difference between the two subject pools that I have here. So in labs, in subjects in the lab were paid in cash at the end of the experiment, which is the traditional procedure. We wanted to see if we could achieve consistency of result by sticking as much as possible to the traditional procedures in the lab. But online, we couldn't do that, so we implemented that procedure. Yeah.
Was the difference in size and subject pools was because just the way the randomization was done, or was it an attrition factor?
Yeah, that's a good question. In fact, generally, so a university laboratory has only 20 seats. So you can seat only 20 persons there. But what you usually do to be sure that you have 20 persons in the room is that you overbook your sessions. And you refuse any additional participant that comes in. So that's what we did. But online, we did not do that because we had no reasons to do so. So we accepted all participants who showed up. But the attrition rate was pretty similar in both studies.
Okay, so the attrition rate doesn't result in, like, there's no significant variation.
It was the same.
The next question was, if you're performing it up to 20 people at a time, are they sitting? I mean, they're sitting at their individual terminals.
Yeah.
But are they sitting in the same room at the same time? So there's like this kind of co-presence where they're
exactly.
all taking the studies at the same time?
There are sessions effect.
Interesting.
So all people are in the room at the same time. They do not actually see each other during the experiment. They see each other before and after the experiment. And this is important also for what is going on.
Are there any game elements where you actually, for the online setting, where you actually require people to be there at the same time, or are they all sequential?
No, we do not require online participants to be there at the same time. So we record all of their decisions, and then we match their decisions with the record of the previous participations online, and this determines their results. And this is true both online and in the lab. The difference between that in the lab, subjects are matched within the room. And this is common knowledge.
So I mean, just the way to think about this is that there's a series of, correct me if this is wrong. But there's a bunch of differences, including the way they're paid and so on and so forth. But those differences are all differences between the way in which we would expect people to run any similar types of experience online and the way in which people have run experiments in the past. So that's the comparison that we're trying to make.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's definitely the case.
Wouldn't it have been better to have given the incentives to everyone through PayPal? Because the treatment differences could be an account of some of them receiving it by PayPal and some of them receiving hard cash.
Yeah.
So your treatment is a composite of multiple factors. And so how do you sort of localize it to the lab versus the online media difference rather than the payment method?
We don't. Again, the question we were asking here is it possible to achieve consistency of results by designing an experimental platform that's specifically designed for an online experiment? We try to control for a bunch of factors, but according to the results that I get, I would go straight in your direction for further inquiries and further experiments.
Because if that was the case, you could have fixed your problem by just paying everybody through PayPal and then not to have to worry about that.
But you wouldn't be able to compare to previous lab experiments.
That's right. I will let you guys do the conclusion of my presentation, because that's exactly where I'm going.
What you're doing is very reasonable.
Yeah, it's definitely where I'm going, so you're anticipating right the problems with this study.
I have one more question.
Now, if we're doing this in a lab and you have me matched against her, then she needs to wait for my response, and then I need to wait for her response, and back and forth. Now, online, you're saying this can be totally asynchronous? So I would not be waiting for her, and then she would not be waiting for me?
No.
Well, none of your data,
even though my decisions depend on her last action?
Excuse me?
None of those games have more than two decisions.
So in the lab, this is always the case. In the lab, what you usually do is that you run one experiment, you wait for everybody to finish the experiments, and then you go to the next game. Online, you're not obliged to do that because we store all your answers, and then we match them with the previous record of answers that we already have, and this determines your results. So you don't have to wait.
But isn't my response to the next situation going to depend on her response to the last situation?
No, because you only find out what the result of the interactions were at the very end of the study.
Oh, okay.
So you have no idea what's going on, what are the results, until the very end of the study.
Well, this is in the live situation also?
Yeah, in both cases.
You never know what the other person has done until you've done all
exactly,
the games.
Exactly. It's exactly the same procedures, both online and in the lab. So you do not get feedback about what happened in one game.
Not like your response is going to adjust.
No, definitely not.
What you've done.
Right. Definitely
How
not.
About the ultimatum game, for example? You need to know what the other person did in order to accept the ultimatum or not. So you need to know whether you were offered.
No. What we actually do is that we ask participant B's to state their minimum acceptable offer. So what is the threshold under which we will refuse?
Instead of asking for choice, you basically ask them for strategy.
A strategic decision.
So it's a strategy method, not the
definitely.
Option.
That's what we do.
And the final game as well, I forget its name, do they decide before different increment levels how much they would return to participate?
Exactly.
Okay.
That's exactly. Strategy method.
Okay.
So for each transfer that participant A could make, how much do you want to send back? And this is what we match. Mm-hmm. And this actually allows us to gain much more data about the behavior of people. If you only observe in the ultimatum game, for instance, a decision about a rejection, the information that you get is rather poor, as opposed to a minimum acceptable offer, where when you actually know the whole distribution of what the subject considers as acceptable or not.
If you have a repeated game, the number of strategies just goes up a lot.
We don't have repeated games. So subjects play the games only once.
But you cannot scale it, so basically this is the limit.
Yeah.
You can do it with very simple games, but not beyond that.
Yeah, that's what we did.
So based on what we know so far, we should be very surprised if the online and offline are different.
Maybe you should.
Sure.
Maybe you should.
No spoilers.
Depends on your disposition.
Yeah.
Hey, Jerome, can I ask you one more question?
Yeah, please.
Just about the lab game. I'm curious what the lab is like and where it is.
So the lab is...
Is there a picture?
That was it. The lab is like this.
That is the lab.
This is not... The lab is like that.
And what building is it in? I mean, where is it in the university? Is it
it's
in
the university
department? Is it in the...
Yeah, it's the economics department at the University of Paris Sorbonne.
Yeah, yeah.
And they have like a room there that looks like that. You bring your subjects in. They see each other at the beginning of the experiment. You randomly assign them to one terminal.
Yep.
They perform the experiments. They are individually paid by the experimenter in cash at the end of the experiment.
Yeah.
And then there are...
And basically everybody who's participating, like you're saying, is from this pool that's volunteered to do these studies
exactly.
in the past,
Except
later...
Those four exact people on every prior.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do they walk through a hallway in the economics department with, like, bus to, like, famous departments?
Right.
Yeah,
or,
exactly.
Symbols.
They're like a big picture of Milton Friedman on the wall. That's really what it looks like.
Definitely. It's really intimidating.
Like that. Yeah.
So, yeah. So...
Been looming over.
So hopefully we
sorry,
can
Mr.
get
Nash, I'm sorry.
To the results. So here we can see the result of the randomization procedures. So if you focus on the table on the top, you cannot see much. I'm afraid.
We can't see anything.
But trust me, I will try my best to explain this to you without fooling you. So on the on the row on the top, you have all the dimensions according to which we collected information as far as demographic characteristics of our subjects are concerned. And you have also a statistical test for difference between both subject pool in the lab and online. So normally you would expect that no difference arises there. But this is actually not the case. We had bad luck with randomization, and we have one, actually two coefficients that are statistically significant, but those two are highly correlated. They deal about having a father who is not born in France and not being born in France himself. So the probability of not being born in France turns out to be lower in the online subject pool. So this is one dimension that we would need to control for explicitly when we compare the results of social behavior online and in the lab. If you turn to the table below, this is about beliefs. So you are able to see that the first column is the belief that subjects are paired with other human partners, and there is no difference there in the lab and online. This is reassuring. There is also no difference between treatments in the beliefs that we will actually calculate the final earnings as we describe and pay them to the subjects at the end of the study. So both online and in the lab, they hold the same conviction that we will do things as we say.
For the first table, were those results like difference in demographics of the pre-attrition subjects or the differences of subjects that made it through the entire experiment?
Yeah, those are the subjects who participated in the experiment.
Okay, so potentially it could be that certain people whose father was born outside France were more likely to stop the experiment in one situation than the other? Or is that unlikely?
Well,
the attrition was for people that arrived, but you couldn't accommodate them, right? So hopefully if you randomized, probably that wouldn't have an effect on who got checked out.
This is what you would expect, but I have no empirical evidence of that fact because I didn't collect any demographic data of the people who showed up in addition in the lab.
But you're doing it based on when they showed up, so presumably people who were showing up earlier are like slightly more...
You can think about many stories.
I would have been kicked out.
So, yeah. So, you also see that there is no difference between both subject pool in the way subjects reported. This is important. You may not believe that they read the instructions. They both report that they read the instructions seriously, more or less. But there is a difference in the way subjects reported whether they were in a camera environment or not. Subjects online reported that they were in a slightly less camera environment when they performed the study than in-lab subjects. And this is statistically significant. So now we can finally turn to the results. So if you first focus on the table on the top, you have there various measures of various outcome of the social measures that we have. The first row is the basic and conditional contribution to the public good. The second row is the mean of the conditional contribution to the public good, because we actually asked subjects to make their contribution decisions in two different ways. And in the second way, we ask them for each possible contribution, average contribution that the three other group members could make to the common project, how much do you want to contribute? So this allows us, hopefully, to determine the type of the contributor. Is he a conditional cooperator? If others contribute, I'm willing to contribute. Or is he a totally self-interested guy? No matter what others do, I will not contribute. This is the kind of things that we are looking at with this procedure. Third row is the transfer in the dictator game, then the transfer in the ultimatum game, the minimum acceptable offer for participant B in the ultimatum game, the amount sent in the trust game, and the level of risk aversion as measured by the number of A decisions out of the 10 decisions that were made in the risk aversion task. So if you let risk aversion aside, one thing that is really striking from those results is that subjects online seem to consistently behave as if they were more pro-social. And the effect is statistically significant in 5 out of 6 measures. So this is a really striking and consistent fact that we found. If you turn your attention to risk aversion, you actually see that we're able to replicate the fact that online subjects are less risk averse, and the effect is highly statistically significant. So that's the basic story. Yeah. This is coming. So those are only t-tests based on the difference in means. So I do not control for the factors that I was mentioning previously. Next slide.
So what do you mean by pro-social? Are the participants more willing to make contributions?
So what I mean here by more pro-social is that people behave as if they were more altruistic, they had higher norms of fairness, as if they displayed higher trust. This is what I mean. So pro-social are all the norms of social norms and preferences that those games tend to measure, give a sense about. I say as if because I'm not entering a discussion about what trust really is here. This is a question that we ask in experimental economics too, but that's not what this study addresses.
How were the online participants recruited?
So they were recruited from the existing database.
From the same database.
It's the same database.
Yeah. And so these are all people that have been to this same lab in person for different studies.
So maybe they were not, they did not go previously,
yeah,
but they registered online to,
yeah,
participate. So the laboratory has gained some kind of recognition in recent years.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a very wide database of people who are willing to come to perform those experiments because they know they're going to be paid accordingly,
yeah,
afterwards.
And do you interpret the increased pro-sociality online as maybe not really increased pro-social behavior but increased risk aversion, given the fact that they came in? For them, maybe they'd interpret coming in for an appointment and then walking away empty-handed as a greater cost than someone who comes to an online thing?
So this is definitely possible, but I would not say that the effect goes through risk aversion, because risk aversion is actually a poor predictor of many of those measures, but trust.
Yeah.
You may have said that and I missed it, so please... what is the interface exactly at the lab? Do people have to click on a button to say how much money to put in? Do they have to write a number, or do they have to count money? And, you know, they're presented with a pile of money and they have to decide how much to put.
Yeah, that's true. I should have put an example of decision screen. So the decision screen actually is a very simple screen on the top with written like, this is the time where you take your decision. Once you take your decision, you will not be allowed to go back to this decision. And you actually have a slider where you decide how much do you want to send, how much do you want to contribute, how much do you want to transfer from 0 to 10.
And is there any reason why you didn't use the same kind of slider in the online and you used the button
it was,
of clicking?
No. It was the exact same interface, both in the lab and online.
Good.
So everything, as far as the interface is concerned, is exactly the same, but the payment process, as I said. Yeah.
Now, you said the people who are chosen to be online versus the lab, you're picking from the exact same pool.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like one of the groups is less, quote, weird than the other.
Yeah.
No, those are weird subjects.
Okay.
All of them.
All equally weird.
We stick to weird subjects, yeah.
Okay.
But this is a methodological paper, so yeah. I'm not going.
So, what do you think is the external validity of this
exercise? So this is a difficult question. But also a very interesting one. But the external validity of laboratory experiments are generally very unequal and tend to be rather low. But my hope, and I will say more in the conclusion. Maybe I will address the question if you like, you may come back to that, if that's okay. So if you now focus on the table below, you get a sense of how much time people spent with the experiments both online and in the lab. And you actually see that on average, on the lab, people spent 36 minutes with the experiments, 32 minutes online. The difference is statistically significant, but not actually as large as I would have expected. The standard deviation, the variability in time spent with the experiment, is significantly higher online. I remember by looking at the data that one subject performed the experiments online in less than 10 minutes, and another one spent like more than 4 hours with the experiment, with not having his mouse inactive for more than 5 minutes a single time.
Oh,
wow.
Shitty earned.
But he wasn't. The mouse wasn't necessarily moving over that page the whole time, right? Or it was.
Oh, it was. Over that particular page.
Wow. Calculations. Wow.
So, but maybe he was doing something and basically coming back just before the 5 minutes each time. I don't know, but...
Okay. Right.
So those are basically the same results, but with all the controls I was talking about. So you have the controls about the fact that you're not born in France, the control about the experimental environment, whether it's calm or not, and coefficients associated with the time that you spent with each game that we consider here in the row. So those are the same measures. And what you can see, maybe not, is that the effects remain economically large and highly statistically significant for 3 out of 6 measures. Those are the transfer in the dictator game, the amount that you send in the trust game, and the level of risk aversion that you exhibit. So more altruism-like behavior online, more trust online, less risk aversion online. Those are the results for the return that participant B's decide to make in the trust game, depending on the amount that participant A is willing to send. So for each possible amount sent by participant A, how much participant B is willing to send back, both online and in the lab. What you can see is that as we traditionally get from experiments in the lab, trust does not quite pay back in the lab. So there is positive reciprocity, but participant B's tend to repay slightly less than participant A send. But this is actually not the case online. So online, there is also positive reciprocity, but the distribution of the behavior online strictly dominates the distribution of the behavior in the lab. And the effect is statistically significant even at the level of each decision. So this is highly statistically significant. And so it seems that people online do not only behave as if they were more trusting, they also behave as if they were more trustworthy. This is another way to look at the results for risk aversion, where I basically plot in the lab and online for each of the 10 decisions that I previously explained to you between the risky gamble and the less risky gamble, the proportion of subjects that decide to go for the risky option. So in the first decisions, this proportion is rather low in both treatments, which seems reasonable. And at the last decision, decision 10, this rises to 100% for the risky decisions because basically you have a 100% chance to get the higher amount in that decision. But still, yet again, you observe that for each decision, the distribution for the subjects online strictly dominates the distribution for the subjects in the lab, and the effect is, again, highly statistically significant.
Understand that one. Isn't that like what the gentleman said before? So they're more risk averse in the lab? Is that what that's showing?
They are there are less risk averse online.
So more okay, gotcha. So that is what you were suggesting.
Yeah, I was saying since you already you incur a greater cost coming into the lab. Mm-hmm. So if you have if everyone has risk averse preferences, then the fact that they already had a big cost coming into the lab means they're going to be more risk averse, which in the context of pro-social games means more selfish.
So, again, as far as the risk aversion measure is concerned, your story is perfectly possible. I cannot disentangle those effects.
Yeah.
But this is not what's actually driving the results in the other games. Mm-hmm. This is something that I can control for. Yeah. Well, I've spoken way too much. So a quick conclusion. So just to summarize, we construct one of the first online platforms specifically designed for conducting social experiments at a very large scale today. We design a randomized experiment in order to answer the question whether it is possible by designing a proper online laboratory to achieve consistency of results, of behavioral results, both online and in the lab. And turns out that this is not what we get. We find that online subjects behave as if they were more altruistic than in-lab subjects. They behave as if they were more trusting and also more trustworthy than in-lab subjects. And they also behave as if they were less risk-averse than in-lab subjects. So maybe two very quick notes about those preliminary findings. The first one being that, in fact, finding that people behave differently in a traditional university lab and online does not invalidate neither the online methodology nor the online results. What it actually does is that it teaches about the importance of context in decision making. And this is something that we have been aware of from a very long time, from the whole literature, especially in economics, but also in psychology, mostly in psychology, I would say, about framing effects. But we didn't know that in the case of online experiments. So my basic reaction to this is that if context has such a dramatic effect on decision-making, and that we actually want to study how online communities work and how people behave online, what we really want to do is to bring the tools of experimental economics online, that is, on the field, so that rather than trying to bring those people that we want to study in a traditional lab, so that we can indeed create a context that is as similar as possible to the one in which agents that we want to study operate. So that's my first reaction to those preliminary findings. Please.
A couple of comments. I assume that your major point, despite these differences between online and in the lab, the major point is you can simulate an experiment online substantially the same as in the lab. Substantially the same. Not exactly on risk aversion. Mm-hmm. Altruism, but simple. Now, the difference in altruism and risk aversion suggests that an application might be for conflict resolution in a larger population, assuming that they will be more cooperative and less risk averse in an online situation than in a simulated lab. That's one thing. The other question or suggestion is, have you talked to Esther Duflo at JPAL, Poverty Action Lab, about applying this to her field social experiments using online surveys of response, randomized response, as a way of economically getting a larger population and reducing the variance?
So that's something that, so on your second point about Esther Duflo, So Esther Duflo is mainly concerned about explaining running randomized experiments about what actually work as development policies in the developing world. And running experiments in the developing world on the field is an alternative strategy for broadening the sample of subjects that is available along with the internet. So
your presentation just got very spooky.
Yeah, I see that. So those are complementary strategies, I would say, because you can reach more diverse samples online, but still you are getting to rather industrialized country right now. So field experiments in the developing world is a complementary approach to this one for broadening the samples of subjects that you have, in my view. So I don't know if that quite answers your question. But the second thing to answer your first question... So conflict resolution, I'm not quite sure that... So maybe we could talk about that one after the talk. I've been interested in. Yeah. But about your first point, it's my second note. In fact, our findings are at odds with what some economists may have predicted according to social distance theory. So what happens is that in the lab, as I previously said, participants can see each other before the experiment, after the experiment, and even during the experiment, if not physically, they know that they are paired with the same people in the room. And people who are coming to those kind of experiments generally share common traits like their age, their social class, their nationality, their school, such things. So it does not seem unrealistic to anticipate that pro-social behavior could be more likely to arise in the laboratory setting as compared to the internet setting where anonymity is much more stringent. So what explanation can we provide for our results? I think that we need further experiments to be on solid ground on that that aspect. I would personally like to argue with a couple of recent econ papers that just came out that what is driving the results here is that the nature of the internet itself, where people are actually accustomed to behave altruistically, to being trusting and trustworthy, even in a highly anonymous setting where one-shot interactions are more the rule than the exceptions, that this natural setting, as opposed to the rather artificial and strategic setting of the lab, is what drives the results. But I don't think that I have the data at hand to make that point forcefully right now. And as you said, one of the first directions I would go for now is try to see if I can replicate those results by having the same exact payment method for both subject pools and design further experiments to try to get a better sense of what's happening. So, yeah, please.
I wanted to first build up part of the discussion earlier, the effect of walking into an economics department with the image of Milton Friedman looping. Is that who it was?
I was pretending.
And I'm sure you're familiar with like the Wall Street community game. There's the study where if you set the context, this is the Wall Street game versus this is the community game. People behave very differently, and I wonder.
To run in a psychology department.
So. Right, exactly, or at the Kennedy School, which is about public.
I'm sure that this would change. I'm sure that this would change the results that you get. That's obvious. There may also be some kind of experiment or effect going on that we cannot really control for, where you are in a university lab. Usually, the experimenter, about half of the session, like it was myself, runs walks. On the room, and you may feel that the experimenter is scrutinizing you, and he's paying you in hand at the end of the experiment, so you get face-to-face contact. But again, this to me, well, I don't know. I don't want to make hypotheses about the sense of the direction of the... Dennis?
Well, I was thinking that you have kind of two conclusions that are slightly at odds with each other, and I would want you to be more radical about which way you're going. So the one conclusion is that making these experiments online is just a better way to do it. And actually, none of these effects matter because, as you said, the design of the experiment affects the conclusions. So basically, you're saying here's a ruler, here's like a better ruler, and it doesn't matter that it has these different, slightly different results. We should all use this new ruler. That would be one way to go. And another way to go is to say, well, look, the design, this difference is actually bring into question this whole endeavor of rulers, of universal measures, because every little thing that we do so this experiment should be radically contextualized. We should only do, but then you have to go again further than this, then, because then it's still kind of an artificial environment that you're setting up. And so those are, to me, in conflict. So I don't know. No.
So I see two questions in your question.
Yeah.
The first one being, finally, at the end of the day, is this a better way to go? And this all depends on what you're studying, in my view. So if you want to study online communities, the fact that you see framing, it seems that you see framing effects that may be due to an internet effect. That's why I put internet effect in quotation mark here, because I don't want to speculate about the nature of the effect. We still don't know. But if context is important, if you want to study online communities, you really need to run your studies online. Then, if you want to run more traditional economics experiments online, because you want to increase your statistical power, reach broader sample, more diverse samples, and compare those results to the results that you get in the lab, this is something that you can do, but then this difference is important when you interpret your results. And the second question that you had, I just forgot. Could you remind me?
I think the two ways are, this is a better way to go, or this brings into question the whole enterprise of running experiments in the lab.
So if you're trying, if your attempt is to eliminate context in decision-making by putting people in the frame of a lab where you think that you can control the environment fully, this is not a good way to go. You cannot eliminate context in decision-making. That's my take in that story. So if you're trying to eliminate context from the story, you do not succeed by bringing people in a university lab. The worst thing that you may end up with is people projecting their own context onto the laboratory that you bring to them, and this is not something that you can control for. This is the worst situation. But where the lab is useful is that it's comparable. So for about this kind of replicability and experiments building on one another, about which I was talking about, having the same environment for each and every experiment has been very useful in the last two decades to actually create common knowledge and create consensus about what is really going on in those games. But as I said, now we are at a turning point, and we need to try to broaden the sample and diversify the methods.
Thank you so much.